Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Even though I am sick, I decided to do the podcast because Derek threatened to dock my pay and cut my benefits, so I'm doing it anyway. So just very quick housekeeping, as they say in the podcast.
I mean, that's just good business. I don't understand why I'm going to be dragged for this. Like,
you learned from the best, Derek, the best oligarchs in the world. You are reading their books. You are learning the art of the deal. And I can't begrudge someone for being good at business. But very quick housekeeping. ChinesePrestigePod.com. Check it out. We got a lot of cool episodes coming up next week for the Christmas week. So keep your eyes and ears open for those. And as always, if you'd like to get into some fun convos, join our Discord. And you can check out all of our old series at AmericanPrestigePod.com. And Derek, I'll hawk something I haven't hawked in a while. If you subscribe at the level of $60 a year, you not only get an annual subscription to our podcast, including access, including your subscription to our series like the Chinese Prestige podcast, and we have a bunch of other forthcoming series, but you also get a digital subscription to The Nation magazine. So if you haven't yet, please consider subscribing at that $60 level. All right, Derek, let's jump into it. Let's start with Thailand and Cambodia, where Trump has declared a ceasefire despite the fact that fighting continues.
Right. I mean, I don't want to criticize the man who should have won the Nobel Peace Prize and frankly was robbed of it, and the man who won the first ever FIFA Peace Prize, potentially even a greater honor, I would think, than the Nobel. I would never question his capabilities as a peacemaker, but Donald Trump did speak with the prime ministers of Thailand and Cambodia on Friday. That is Anutin Charnvirakul, I'm sorry if I'm mangling that, and Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Manet on Friday, as I said, and claimed after he spoke with both of them that he had restored the ceasefire that has been in place since earlier this year and that fell apart over the past, I guess it's been almost 2 weeks at this point, as fighting has resumed. They haven't stopped fighting. It's been about a week since this phone call and since Trump made this declaration. When people listen to this, it will have been a week. Maybe the fighting will have stopped by tomorrow. I don't know. But for right now, as we're recording this, the fighting has continued. There's been a bit of a lull over the past day or so, I gather, from what I've seen, but not much of one. And it's still there's no indication that either side has stopped fighting or has declared its own ceasefire. So as far as I'm aware, this conflict is still going on. The fighting continued through the week. It even seemed to escalate at one point. The Cambodian military accused Thailand of striking targets deeper inside Cambodia, so expanding the range of its airstrikes. These included a couple of displaced persons camps, dozens of kilometers away from the border. There was another point at which the Thai foreign ministry issued a statement that said this cannot end until the Cambodian government declares its own unilateral ceasefire, and then we can talk about a full cessation of hostilities, characterizing the Cambodians as the aggressor in this conflict, which I think the Cambodians would probably disagree with. And at any rate, they have not declared a unilateral ceasefire. So we're still in this. There were even reports on Wednesday of Cambodian soldiers, wounded Cambodian soldiers, describing the possible use of chemical weapons by the Thai military. I think you want to be very careful about that because there's no independent evidence of the Thai military using chemical weapons. The Thai military denies it. They have acknowledged using white phosphorus, which is a chemical that is used in military applications. Ostensibly, it is supposed to be used to illuminate a dark battlefield or to provide smoke screens for enemy movements. If it is used against human beings, it is a chemical weapon. It can burn if it comes in contact with skin. And if the smoke is inhaled, it can cause reactions similar to other types of chemical weapons. And I think similar to the symptoms that these Cambodian soldiers were describing, which sounded like a pulmonary kind of choking agent they were describing, not being able to breathe, irritation in their air passages. So it's possible that white phosphorus could be the reason here. But anyway, it's a very provocative charge that was just made, just began to filter out on Wednesday. And as I say, there's been a little bit of a lull in the fighting, but still nothing definitive. And as far as I know, they're continuing to batter each other.
War goes on everywhere, Derek. It is a really grim century. All right, let's move on to Israel. Speaking of grim, let's move on to Israel-Palestine.
Yeah,
no, it's pretty brutal. This one is also terrible. Let's talk about Israel-Palestine, and let's start with the Israeli strike in Gaza, which not only has threatened the ceasefire, but has actually made the United States angry.
It's given us another round of stories about how the U.S. is angry. I don't know how much to rely on that, but the Israeli military killed five people, I believe, on Saturday in an airstrike in northern Gaza that targeted and killed a Hamas official, supposedly the head of their weapons production operation, a man named Raad Saad. Israeli officials didn't really offer much of a justification for this other than to say, we got this guy who is a high-level Hamas official and was allegedly involved in planning the October 7th attacks. They did offer some comment about an earlier explosion that had taken place in Gaza on the Israeli side of the so-called yellow line as some justification for the strike. But I think they didn't really stress that. And for most observers, this was just a unilateral Israeli attack, which is a clear violation of the ceasefire, right? I mean, there's wiggle room for the Israelis to respond if they say that Hamas is, instigated some sort of violence or attacked them. But otherwise, even if you see a target of opportunity, even if the Israelis see a target of opportunity ripe for being taken out, they can't, under the ceasefire, do that. It's a violation of the ceasefire. And even, as you said, the Trump administration has apparently noted this because we've gotten another round of stories this week featuring Barak Ravid at Axios, who always seems to get this story, that the U.S. is frustrated with Benjamin Netanyahu, that the Trump administration, U.S. officials told the Israelis that they're not going to allow Netanyahu to ruin Donald Trump's reputation by wrecking the ceasefire, send a very pointed message. No actual tangible repercussions, of course, just a reprimand. But we've gotten a round of that. There's another story, I think, from Ravid on Thursday that the U.S. is planning now a meeting with the other guarantors of the ceasefire. That would be representatives of Qatar, Turkey, and Egypt to discuss where things stand. Of course, this is still stuck on phase one, so-called phase one of Donald Trump's ceasefire plan for a variety of reasons. But they're going to have this meeting without, apparently, at least as far as I could tell, any Israeli representation. So that may also reflect the administration's frustration or supposed frustration after the strike.
And the other brutal news is, of course, this winter storm, which has devastated Gaza. And you see the videos on your social feed. But Derek, what has actually been going on there?
As we talked about with Rashid Khalidi a few days ago, Gaza is entering the Eastern Mediterranean winter, which is a brutal time of year. It's cold, it's rainy. And people with almost the entire population of Gaza displaced and either trying to shelter in damaged buildings or in tents that are really only adequate for sort of shade from the sun, are not at all up to the task of protecting people from the kind of inclement weather they're seeing now. It's starting to set in. I mean, the effects of, there's already been one major storm that's hit the region, and there are more coming, certainly, and just the overall downturn of the weather. There's been over a dozen casualties. I had seen 14 at one point, but now the most reporting seems to have settled on more than a dozen casualties due to various aspects of the situation. There's been a couple of instances, at least one that I know of, in which a person was killed because they were sheltering in a damaged building, and the rain was so heavy that it collapsed the building. There have been several people who have died of exposure or hypothermia, including two infants so far. And the key thing here is the Israeli government is not allowing shelter materials into Gaza. This is part of what is supposed to be coming in under the ceasefire. This influx of aid that we're supposed to be seeing, that we're really not. They're still not meeting the target of 600 trucks per day, even according to the Israeli government's own figures. The main category of material that's not being allowed in are durable shelter materials, because the Israelis claim that metal poles or the other, you know, kind of the building materials could be repurposed as weapons, which is horseshit, basically. But that's the justification for not allowing this stuff in. And in the meantime, you know, tents are flooding. People are, as I say, dying of exposure. They're dying because they're sheltering in unsafe, structurally unsound buildings, and this is just going to continue. And at this point, it's almost too late to avoid the worst of this. Like, you would have to be go in and start constructing sites, clearing out sites, and constructing these shelters in the middle of the conditions that you're trying to avoid. So this is stuff that should have been taken care of weeks ago. And at this point, even if the Israelis, you know, did a 180 and started allowing stuff in, it may be too late for a lot of people.
So, Derek, you just did an episode on Yemen with Anel Shaleen of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. But for those who are unable to listen to that episode, which we made available to all free of charge, wow, how generous are we? Let's talk about Yemen, and let's talk about the separatists preparing to announce a new government, maybe?
This is reporting in Arabic language media today. And I mean, to briefly recap, the Southern Transitional Council, which is a separatist movement nominally aligned with the Yemeni government in the conflict against the Houthis in northern Yemen, but really wants to establish or reestablish an independent, they're calling it South Arabia, would be South Yemen, the former nation of South Yemen. They've moved into several provinces. Their fighters have moved into several provinces, Hadramut, Mahra, now Abyan most recently. And seem to be sort of taking over sites, especially oil sites in Hadramut. So there's a good deal of activity here. What's unclear is where things stand in the kind of big picture political level. The nominally internationally recognized government has fled Aden. The senior leadership of the STC appears to be in that city now, which has functioned as the de facto capital of the Republic of Yemen since the Houthis seized Sana'a several years ago. Seems to be the STC seems to be functioning as a government at this point, but hasn't declared anything definitive. Now, this report that I've seen in Arabic language media, that's where it was originally reported, is that they could, within the next several weeks, I guess, declare a new government, whether it would be explicitly separatist or whether they would declare the founding of a new nation or a restored South Yemen, whatever you want to call it. I don't know, but they could declare just a new administration in Aden in an official capacity, which would be a direct challenge to the internationally recognized government, which is backed by the Saudis. Of course, the STC, as we talked about, as I talked about with Anel, the STC is backed heavily by the United Arab Emirates. This is part of a rivalry between those two countries. But that would be a major development if it takes place. And it seems like things are heading in that direction.
And Derek, there's also scuttlebutt on the street that the Saudis might invade.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, the Saudis back the Republic of Yemen government, which is really more an arm of the Saudi government at this point. But they've been reportedly quite unhappy that the SDC has been going around southern Yemen, seizing sites and, you know, taking down flags and, you know, doing a lot of things that seem to call into question the integrity of Yemen. You know, how the degree to which the Saudis would be prepared to go to war, let's say, or to fight any kind of major, kind of put any effort into preserving the Yemeni government, it remains to be seen. But there is a report that they have gathered thousands of fighters, thousands of personnel. The term is Saudi-backed forces that I'm seeing. I don't exactly know what that means, but that they've gathered that force on the border of South Yemen or between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, in the east, so in Hadramut and Mahra, I believe. So they're at least threatening potential military action. There have been talks of airstrikes. At one point, the Saudis, I think we mentioned this, closed Yemeni airspace briefly in response to these STC activities. But then, you know, that was just just seemed like a warning. This may be something else entirely. We'll have to wait and see what comes of it.
Thanks, Derek. All right, let's talk about Taiwan, which has just received the largest ever American arms package valued at $11 billion.
A little bit over $11 billion, actually. Yes, this is just being reported on Thursday that the U.S. State Department announced, apparently in a late Wednesday document dump, that it has approved an $11.1 billion arms sale to Taiwan. As you said, this is the largest U.S. arms sale to Taiwan ever in monetary value. It includes a number of systems that look like things that the U.S. has been providing to Ukraine, which is interesting because a lot of these arms sales to Taiwan tend to deal in very high-end or relatively high-end equipment, things that would be easily destroyed by the Chinese military in the event of an invasion and things that would not probably work well in defending Taiwan. This sale focused on rocket systems, multiple rocket launchers, the Army Tactical Missile System, which is the long-range munitions for the U.S. High-mobility artillery rocket system, the HIMARS, which has been used to great effect by the Ukrainians, howitzers, you know, things that are a little bit harder to destroy and potentially could cause some pain to the Chinese military in the event of invasion. So this may reflect a bit of a shift in terms of the prioritization of weapons. I don't know enough about the package to say that for sure, but it does seem like maybe they're learning some lessons from Ukraine in dealing with Taiwan and supplying weapons to Taiwan. The thing that everybody's waiting for, I think, is the angry statement from China, which may have already come out. It probably will already have emerged by the time people listen to this. You know, kind of criticizing this, which is almost certainly will, but that hasn't happened to my knowledge yet.
Thanks, Derek. All right, let's talk about China. You were just talking about China, but let's continue. Let's talk about this prototype of the advanced chip making tool that they seem to have.
This is interesting. I mean, it for people who listened to our conversation with Bob Wright, I thought this might be an interesting follow-up. Reuters reported this on Wednesday that Chinese scientists have apparently built a prototype of what's called an extreme ultraviolet lithography machine, which is what is used to manufacture the most advanced semiconductor chips for things like AI, weapons, smartphones. These are the chips that the U.S. has been really trying to prevent China from getting access to, although the Trump administration has shifted a bit on that front of late. The estimates from people in the chip making industry have been, you know, that China is years and years away from producing this kind of equipment. That doesn't seem to be the case if they have a working prototype. Now, they haven't produced any chips with it, and it could still be a few years before they're able to really refine it to the point where they could make chips that compete with the kinds of things that the West is able to produce. Nevertheless, this seems like a pretty major development if it proves accurate.
Thanks, Sarek. All right, let's talk about this attack that happened on the Hanukkah event in Australia at Bondi Beach, which appears to maybe have been related to the Islamic State.
What I've seen from Australian authorities strongly suggests, I mean, they seem to be pushing this line that it was an Islamic State related attack, not an Islamic State attack, but that at least one of the two people who was involved, there were two shooters, a father and a son. The son had already been on the radar of Australia's domestic intelligence agency for several years over suspicions that he was tied to a local Islamic State cell. Details, I haven't seen much detail beyond that. At least 15 people were killed plus the father. So a total of 16 people, but one of the shooters and 15 victims. The son, the second shooter, is in, last I saw, was in critical condition, was in custody and in critical condition in the hospital. I don't know much more beyond what I've already said. There are indications that the son was at least influenced by Islamic State ideology. There's been a statement issued, I believe, by Islamic State through its channels, sort of praising the attack without taking responsibility for it. And this is something that jihadist groups often do when there's somebody who's been sort of inspired by their ideology or their rhetoric, but didn't have a direct connection to the organization. So it may be something like that. There's obviously been a lot of attention and effort put into connecting this incident to the rise in anti-Semitism in Australia, which has been documented. If it's an Islamic State attack, I don't know how applicable sort of the general trend in rising anti-Semitism is to something like that. But certainly that's also part of the background here that people have been discussing.
Let's move on to Somalia, where the New America Foundation has released a report that shows the extent of American bombing there.
New America keeps track of what it is able to confirm in terms of U.S. strikes in Somalia, and it has counted 114 U.S. strikes in Somalia so far this year, which is a bit higher than the figure that U.S. Africa Command, the U.S. Military's Africa Command, offers. It's counting, or it's saying that it's conducted 87 airstrikes or 87 military attacks in Somalia this year. So New America's figure is a little bit higher than that. What's really stunning, aside from that number, which is stunning in itself, 114 strikes in a single year on Somalia, which doesn't get that much attention relative to the amount of U.S. military, the extent of U.S. military activity there. What's really striking in their tallies, they've been doing this for years. They've been doing it since the George W. Bush administration. Since George W. Bush started bombing Somalia, he's the one who kicked it off in 2003. It has counted 443 U.S. strikes on Somalia since Bush began in 2003. 333 of them have taken place during Donald Trump's 5 years, or almost 5 years, as president. So a stunning proportion, a stunning emphasis by Trump. And again, one that doesn't get a lot of attention as we sort of pay attention to the things that he does in Venezuela or, you know, his supposed peacemaking efforts around the world, FIFA Peace Award winner. Meanwhile, he's, you know, his military is bombing the shit out of Somalia. And there's no sense that there's any strategic plan to this or any sort of agenda that the administration is trying to meet. One suspects, given the way that Donald Trump talks about Somalia, he simply doesn't care. This is a good place for him to, bomb. He considers Somalis, according to him, garbage. So he's really not doing anything that he would regard as harmful to anyone by killing them. So I think that's there's a lot of that built up in this. It's just a place that the Trump administration views with complete disdain, that Donald Trump himself views with complete disdain. And so it's a place to sort of get your war on without seeming any consequences that that Trump would care about.
Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your cachava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of cachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's kachava, kachava.com, and use code NEWS.
Let's turn to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and let's talk about the fact that M23 has announced its withdrawal from, forgive my pronunciation, Uvira.
Yes, we talked about M23's capture of that city, which is in South Kivu province in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, right along the Burundian border, earlier this month. The group announced, or actually the Congo River Alliance, which is the coalition that includes M23, announced on Tuesday that it will leave, or it was planning to leave Uvira, and details beyond that were a little up in the air. But that came after a couple of days of the Trump administration really laying into the Rwandan government, Rwanda being M23's foreign backer, over the offensive that you know ended with M23 in control of the city. Mike Waltz, the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, had gone to the Security Council and had some harsh words for Rwanda about this, and said they were threatening regional peace, and heavy criticism, and that appears to have motivated, shall we say, M23 to quit the city. The head of the Congo River Alliance, a man named Corneille Nangaa, said that this withdrawal was supposed to be a unilateral trust-building measure to give peace talks a chance to succeed. And there are peace talks still ostensibly going on between the Congolese government and M23, or the Congo River Alliance, that are being mediated by the Qatari government. Donald Trump, just earlier this month, brokered a peace deal signing ceremony between the presidents of the DRC and Rwanda. So, it's a lot invested again in this process. Trump wants access to the minerals of the Eastern Congo, and that requires kind of tamping down the violence there. So there's a lot that's invested in this. So far, there is evidence of a withdrawal underway. Al Jazeera released video on Wednesday that seemed to show M23 fighters leaving Uvira. What's up in the air is where these fighters are going to deploy to. How far outside of the city are they going to go? What is M23 going to do if the Congolese military tries to move into Uvira and retake it? They've proposed leaving it as a sort of demilitarized or buffer zone. There's also a question, and AFP reported on this on Thursday, about the presence of what it's calling police forces that M23 had put in place in Uvira, who have not left. There's still evidence that they are in the city. It's possible they'll be the last, armed forces to leave, or it's possible they might try to stay, which would then call into question whether this is a real withdrawal or not. But these are all things that are still up in the air.
Let's move on to Ukraine, where the war is about to enter its fourth year. Let's talk about the peace talks.
There have been several rounds of peace talks at this point. The U.S. and Ukrainian teams met again in Berlin earlier this week, Sunday into Monday, to try to hash out a unified proposal that could be presented to the Russian government. I don't think they managed to do that, although Volodymyr Zelensky suggested that they produced a what he called a very workable draft. That's his comment. On the other hand, reporting suggests that the U.S. and Ukraine are still very far apart on the key issue of territorial concessions, with the U.S. wanting Ukraine to give up the territory that it still holds in the Donbass, and the Ukrainians refusing to do that. There are formulations that could unlock that, but they would have to be agreed to by the Russians as well. And one of those formulations that's been proposed is sort of leaving the area as a demilitarized zone that's not really claimed by either country, or maybe, you know, sort of nominally claimed by Russia, but they don't exert any military, they don't have any military position there. You know, any of those things would probably not go over well in Moscow, but they haven't been presented yet in a formal sense. There is a meeting now planned for this weekend in Miami between U.S. and Russian teams, I guess, to discuss the results of the negotiations between the U.S. and the Ukrainians and the Europeans to some extent. There does seem to be something close to common ground, at least in the reporting I've seen, in terms of security guarantees for Ukraine. These would involve not NATO membership, but Article 5-like guarantees of protection from the U.S. And European NATO members in the case of another Russian attack. But yeah, with that, I think, you know, nothing is agreed till everything is agreed. And again, the Russians are going to have objections to some of these things, especially if, as I've seen reported, there are elements in here like the deployment of European soldiers on Ukrainian soil. The Russians have been very adamant that they don't, that they're not willing to accept that, that they'll just keep fighting. So yeah, it's a lot to be determined here, and we'll see how the talks go over the weekend between the U.S. and Russia.
And let's also address this issue about the status of Kupiansk.
This is the one thing that seems to be active on the ground. There's a back and forth between Ukrainian and Russian officials about the status of the city of Kupiansk, which is in Kharkiv Oblast in sort of eastern, northeastern Ukraine, and has been targeted heavily by the Russians for months now. Last month, the Russian military claimed that it had taken the city. The Ukrainians denied that, and then subsequently, a couple of weeks later, claimed that they had launched a counterattack that dislodged the Russians from some parts of the city, so they'd retaken some parts of it. Zelensky visited Kupiansk on Friday to sort of demonstrate that Ukrainian control over the city, but I don't think he went into like the city center. He was more on the outskirts of the city. So, it doesn't say a whole lot about actually how much of the city is still in Ukrainian hands. It does indicate that the Russians aren't in control of the whole area, I guess. On Wednesday, the commander of the Ukrainian military, Alexander Sirsky, claimed that the Ukrainians are now in control of 90% of the city after their counterattack. The Russian military simply said that the counterattack was unsuccessful and denied that Ukrainians are holding any part of the city. So, yeah, it's sort of anybody's guess at this point. There doesn't seem to be any independent way to confirm or deny anything that either of these sides is saying.
Thanks, Derek. All right, it's time for the Monroe Doctrine portion of the podcast. Let's turn to the Western Hemisphere, and let's start with Chile, where Kast has won the runoff.
Yes, Jose Kast won Chile's presidential runoff on Sunday. This was expected. He took about 58% of the vote against Ginette Jara, the Communist Party nominee, who won the first round narrowly over Kast, but polling had consistently shown it in a head-to-head matchup he would win. Kast is easily the most right-wing head of state that Chile has had since Augusto Pinochet. So that will be interesting to see what happens. He's part of the apparent backlash, at least in some parts of Latin America, to the so-called second pink tide, if you want to call it that, and certainly hoping to, I think, cultivate better relations with the Trump administration, as has Rodrigo Paz been trying to do in Bolivia, the new conservative president of that country. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Venezuela. Well, Derek, actually, I'm going to pull an audible. Do you think there's going to be a war? Like, what do you think is going on? Like, I always text Derek. I'm like, is it going to be today? And he's like, I don't think so. But what do you think is actually going on?
Yeah, I know you asked if he was going to announce it on that Wednesday speech, and then it just turned out to be him exercising his brain demons and
he does seem to be losing the public discussion, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and we'll actually maybe get into this a little bit in this story, but I do think he's made it very difficult for himself not to at least engage in airstrikes. I'm a little surprised he hasn't already done that. Maybe he doesn't want to trouble people over the Christmas holiday. But I'm a little surprised he hasn't at least made a token, some token airstrikes on Venezuela. That said, I mean, the things that he said this week, it's hard to see how he's going to get out of this short of regime change, looking like he knows what he's doing. And I know he doesn't want to invade, or I'm pretty confident he doesn't want to invade and start another forever war U.S. occupation. But he's really gotten to the point where, like, there's no compromise he could make with Nicolas Maduro that's not just Maduro fleeing for his life, that would make Trump look good. That wouldn't look like Trump backing down. So I think he's painting himself into a corner where he's going to have to do something.
And maybe it might make sense then to move into talking about these new deployments and as well as the blockade.
Right. The U.S. military is kind of encircling Venezuela. Obviously, there's the naval deployment in the Caribbean, which now apparently includes a partial blockade on shipping. We'll get to that in a moment. But there's also increasingly sort of a presence on land. The government of Trinidad and Tobago it announced that it's granting the U.S. military access to the country's airports. And Trinidad is, I think 7 miles off the coast of Venezuela at its closest point. So obviously well positioned for airstrikes on Venezuela. There's no indication of the government in Trinidad and Tobago, insists that it's just, engaging in normal kind of collaborative military efforts and counter-narcotics, anti-crime, that the U.S. military is there to help with those sorts of things. But it certainly would be an advantageous position to have access to Trinidad and Tobago's airports if one were planning to strike Venezuela. The second thing of note here is that the Ecuadorian government announced it is going to accept a deployment of a U.S. Air Force contingent to the Manta Air Base, which is a facility that the U.S. used exclusively through the 2000s. Again, ostensibly, this is about counter-narcotics, but obviously Ecuador also fairly conveniently placed if someone were to, be interested in carrying out airstrikes on Venezuela. We should note here that there was a referendum in Ecuador last month on the question of changing the country's law to allow foreign military bases on Ecuadorian soil, and voters resoundingly rejected that idea. And so kudos to President Noboa for not letting the will of the people stand in his way. Letting the U.S. come on board anyway. Moving to Venezuela, you talked about the blockade. Donald Trump announced in a really borderline social media post on Tuesday or Monday night or Tuesday, I can't remember which, but he announced a blockade on sanctioned vessels going to and from Venezuela, sanctioned oil tankers basically going to and from Venezuela. This is after the U.S. Coast Guard already seized a sanctioned tanker off the Venezuelan coast. A lot of people have pointed out that the U.S. does not really have the legal standing under international law to simply seize these vessels in international waters just because they run afoul of U.S. sanctions. That is true. And yet the question is, and always is with international law, is what is anybody going to do about it, which is nothing. So the U.S. does, in fact, just have the leeway to do as it likes here. So the blockade, it's not a full blockade. And a full blockade would, of course, be an act of war. But the administration can claim that it's not a full blockade because they're only targeting vessels that are under U.S. sanctions. Nevertheless, it is a definite escalation. And, you know, that's sort of where things stand on the ground. The other thing to talk about here is what Trump has said about the oil. Do you want to, we can get into that as well.
Derek, you know I love talking about oil.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, people ask, like, why is the U.S. so interested in Venezuela? Why, you know, why are we doing this? And it's trite to say it's because of the oil, but Trump keeps basically saying it's because of the oil. Like, it's very hard to get around this. And I know, I'm sure there are other you know, elements in the administration. Marco Rubio has other, you know, interests in unseating Maduro. I'm sure that the administration as a whole and Trump and Stephen Miller would like to have a pliable Venezuelan government that would accept mass deportation of Venezuelan nationals without putting up any kind of fuss. I'm sure there's a lot of other things that go into this, but Trump himself keeps talking about the oil. There was a piece in the New York Times this week, a sort of behind the scenes look that said, you know, the internal discussions have focused intensely on Venezuelan oil reserves and other mineral reserves as well, but oil mostly. And again, maybe this has been managed. Maybe this is the message that, you know, people are feeding to Trump to get him on board with doing something because he's, you know, very keen to take the oil and make it America's. But he's also talked openly, and he did again when he announced the blockade, about this grievance that goes back. It goes past Nicolas Maduro. It goes even past Hugo Chavez. It goes all the way back to when Venezuela nationalized its oil industry in the 1970s and took fields and oil rights, stripped them from U.S. companies. Trump brought that back up in his blockade announcement. You know, and has been telling reporters that, like, we're going to get the land back. We're going to get the oil back. They took this from us. So it's really intensely about oil at this point, and has been clear, much even clearer than before over the last few days, that he's exercised about this. Again, I don't know at this point, after everything that's been said and done, how anything short of regime change is going to satisfy Trump's desire not to look like a chump, basically, right? I mean, this is one of his animating considerations: is am I going to look like a chump? He's sort of committed at this point to seeing Maduro off, or else he will, you know, feel like he's been punked.
Nice use of punked. You don't hear that much these days. I think we should bring it back.
Appreciate that.
All right, let's end with the National Defense Authorization Act, which Congress has passed to the tune of $901 billion. What do people need to know about the bill, Derek?
Other than the top line, which is actually higher than the amount that the Trump administration requested, not that much. Congress sometimes jacks these things up by a considerable amount, but with Trump, it was only, I think, $8 billion more than they had requested. But there are a few things of note aside from that. To go back to Syria, which we talked about earlier, the NDAA includes a repeal of the CSER, Syria Civilian Protection Act, which is the 2019 measure that is the basis for most of the punitive sanctions that the U.S. has levied against Syria. the new Syrian government, I guess you could still call it new. It's about a year old at this point. And President Ahmed Ashara have been pleading with the U.S. and the Trump administration for repeal, pleading with legislators when Shara visited D.C. earlier this year, you know, basically lobbying legislators to repeal the CSAR Act and get rid of these sanctions for economic reasons. The U.S., the Trump administration has waived the sanctions in the CSAR Act, or most of them. But that's a temporary measure. You can only do that for 6 months at a time. It has to renew. And consequently, you know, people who are thinking about, you know, companies that are thinking about maybe doing business in Syria, or people who are thinking about investing in Syria, you know, look at that state of affairs and think this is too risky because, you know, these things are only temporarily lifted. And what happens if something should sour the relationship and the sanctions come back on and I'm going to run afoul of them and get in all sorts of trouble? It's just not worth it to me. Repealing the CSAR Act is a bit more permanent. Obviously, you know, Congress could pass something similar tomorrow if it wanted to, but it's a bit more permanent. So it could have a more potent economic effect on Syria with the repeal. There's a couple other things. I thought it was interesting. The Financial Times did a piece on this. There are a number of elements in the NDA that seem to constrain a bit, at least, the Trump administration's ability to militarily disengage from Europe, which is something that's obviously been talked about quite a bit, something that Trump is seems keen to do. But there are stipulations in the NDA that if the number of, for example, the number of U.S. military personnel in Europe drops below 76,000 for more than 45 days, the Secretary of, I'm not going to call him the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Defense and the head of U.S. European Command would have to certify to Congress that the reduction is both in U.S. national interests and has been made in consultation with other NATO members. There are also provisions that could limit the Pentagon's ability to move heavy weapon systems out of Europe and that maintain some financial support for Ukraine, for the Baltic states. So there are a few things in here to try and kind of stymie the Trump administration if the intent is to really pull the U.S. Out of European military matters, out of European defense. The last thing I'll note, and there was a piece about this at Responsible Statecraft that people might want to check out, is that the NDAA requires the Selective Service System to find a way to automatically register 18-year-old males for Selective Service, rather than the current practice, which is you have to do it. You turn 18, you have to go and register for Selective Service yourself. There's a you know, legal requirement to do that, but this would make it automatic, combing through, you know, government databases and whatever information they have. They would just basically register these people automatically. It's not a military draft, obviously, but it is I think, could be viewed as a disconcerting step towards some sort of draft if the government wanted to go in that direction. And certainly you could talk about the use or misuse of private data being held by the government in this way. But that is also another feature of the NDAA that people should be aware of.
Well, thank you, Derek. This will probably be our last news episode of the year, unless something big happens. We're obviously going to take off next week for Christmas. And then the week after that, it's already 2026. So we're going to do another Christmas movie episode this year. So if people want to watch The Muppet Christmas Carol, we'll be doing that with friend of the pod, Justin Boyd. And Derek, I guess we should just be saying goodbye to 2025. What a year.
Yeah, what a great year. Happy holidays, everybody. Yeah,
happy holidays. 2026,
thanks for supporting the show.
Yes, thanks for supporting the show. 2026, sure to be just as
although those of good. You who aren't supporting the show could have lousy holidays, frankly.
Oh, no, Derek. I am magnanimous of spirit and just happy. You are Scrooge. I am Tiny Tim.
All right.
Just wishing everyone a happy holiday season, new year. Enjoy the episodes next week. We've got a few for you. So thank you, everyone. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Indulge in holiday cravings with the nutrition you need from Kachava's All-in-One Whole Body Shake. It's 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Try their newest flavors, like the limited edition Chocolate Mint. With Kachava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS for 15% off.